Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, universities are changing, in part, to appeal to students looking to them to prepare them for employment. But what does this mean for traditional liberal arts education? What is the future of liberal arts programs like philosophy in light of this trend? And first, states with controversial or racist histories are struggling to overcome the influence of these memories on contemporary politics. Is the U.S. haunted by its racist past? What can it do to overcome this history? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In recent weeks, the news in the United States has been filled with stories of statues and public spaces being altered or removed of its controversial subjects. These are usually connected with the U.S.'s racist past, with a particular eye towards the institution of slavery. In this segment, we will explore the debate and examine what this past means for American identity, as well as what it means in contemporary politics. My guest is Jessica Auchter, Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. She's the author of The Politics of Haunting and Memory. And as the author of The Politics of Haunting and Memory, my first question is, how much is the U.S. haunted by its past, and what does that mean for contemporary American politics?
This is a great question. For me, I think being haunted is a choice. So I would say we have to choose to pay attention to ghosts, that it's an ethical and political choice. And for me, this is very much the debate that's going on right now related to statues in the United States, where some are suggesting we're paying insufficient attention to the ghosts of our past. Some are suggesting that we should be paying particular types of attention. So it is very much a debate about which ghosts we should be paying attention to, which stories of our own history come to light, and then how that translates into particular policies or understandings of history. And I think in many ways, this is not unlike the conversations that were had after the fall of Nazi Germany. Who bears responsibility? Who's to blame? What's the role of ordinary people? You've seen an immense emotional response related to this dilemma of guilt or responsibility. And so I think there's also the question of what the role of our emotions is in relation to how we understand our own history. So in some of my research, I've looked at how these sort of ghostly traces disrupt our efforts to try to understand events in linear ways. And I think that's what we're seeing here, is people are striving to sort of achieve a linear understanding of these events, but it may not actually be there. And in grasping for that, they're arriving at radically different understandings of our own history. So I think paying attention to ghosts is a choice. So the U.S. is haunted by its past insofar as individuals who are citizens choose to be haunted by that past and choose to pay attention to those issues. I think we're increasingly coming around to that sort of public opinion.
So with that in mind, if it's your choice, why not just set the past in the past and not, not dredge up all of these terrible memories, all these, this terrible haunting? Why not just ignore it?
There's a lot of people making that argument with regards to this history that, race is only an issue if we talk about it and these sorts of things. But the problem is that up until this point, there's been a very particular version of history that's been told. So I think the question is, the debate that's being had right now about these monuments is an effort to ask, what version of history are we turning into monuments and which voices are being silenced in that? So maintaining the status quo isn't not listening to ghosts at all. It's listening to some ghosts rather than others, I guess I would say. So I think that we should acknowledge that any outcome of this, keeping statues, getting rid of statues, is a particular version of history, which includes particular voices. So maintaining the status quo doesn't mean that sort of you don't have these conversations. It just means they may not be had out in the open. It still involves a whole host of voices that are still being silenced in an attempt to arrive at this particular idea of communal memory.
So this is really more about public space and public discourse versus private discourse. And laying this bare so we can have an honest conversation about the past as opposed to simply forgetting. I know there's certain authors, David Reif's famous title of his book in print was In Praise of Forgetting, or The Importance of Forgetting. Part of the idea of this being haunted means it's really difficult to forget. And there's consequences to that.
Absolutely. I think that for me, what has been so interesting about the debates that have emerged is that we're really seeing more attention paid to how public memory and communal memory gets constructed. And in the past, we sort of took stories for granted. We didn't pay much attention to causes and processes. But now you're seeing a lot of effort to try to complicate the picture. And so for scholars who are interested in memory like myself, the most interesting thing is seeing the general public actually attentive to the way that memories get formed, the way they get solidified through monuments. And I think you're right that what we're seeing is a turn from sort of individual conversations about many of these issues within people's homes to these sorts of issues becoming a significant part of public discourse.
One of the ironies of this is those of us who've studied any sort of American foreign policy and American history are familiar with this concept of American exceptionalism, that the U.S. is somehow this unique case. But this pushback against the acknowledgement of a controversial, if not downright criminal past, or at least criminal acts in that past, is actually quite consistent with how most countries have dealt with their history of atrocities. You mentioned Nazi Germany, but Germany is actually a bit out of the ordinary in their acknowledgement of their past. I think of countries like Turkey's refusal to acknowledge the Armenian genocide, or the Japanese shifting of responsibility for crimes committed during the Second World War. How similar is the U.S. to those types of campaigns? How much does this debunk this notion of American exceptionalism and that most countries don't really want to come to grips with their pasts?
Yeah, I think you're right that the German case is the exception rather than the rule. And one thing that we've seen is that even in the current debate, the sort of self-examination of the perhaps sordid details of US history is being labeled in some corners as profoundly unpatriotic, which of course I think is problematic. I think critique is the highest form of patriotism. And we should be asking ourselves, which part of our history do we want to embrace? Which parts do we not want to embrace? But those aren't debates that are being had in most places about the sort of historical evolution of particular countries. And so in that sense, the US is no different. And a lot of that, I think, comes to the relationship between memory and identity, that countries are literally built, their identities are built on this sort of mythological story, not myth in the sense of not being true, but myth in the sense of this sort of founding story that's told about sort of the country, its values, its ideals. And we know that countries are built on those, and often that is intimately associated with how they remember their own pasts and how those in power remember those pasts. And so it gets back to which voices are part of that conversation of how we should understand our own past. And the fewer voices we include in that, the less likely we are to properly examine the historical account. And I think that does put us in the category of many other countries, but I think it's not a category you want to be in if you're lumped with sort of Turkish genocide denialists. And we should be wary of that. I think examining one's history doesn't mean undermining values that are shared among Americans or things that we hold up to be laudatory in US history or in the contemporary context. But it does mean having a real account about what ideals we may not like so much that have shaped our history and how we reckon with that and the voices that may still be being silenced as a result of those legacies.
One of the fundamental drives in memory research is the recovery of memories of invisible populations. That's one of the more common themes. And broadly, if these are communities that are left out of the national discourse about its own history, it has a profound implication for whether or not these communities are fully a part of the political community in the present. So when Americans don't speak of the experiences, the memories of indigenous populations, what does that mean for contemporary indigenous peoples and whether or not they're considered to be a part of the American identity? But that being said, this is a very, very painful discourse, in particular for dominant communities. So how do you bridge that gap between the need to recognize communities that are generally, historically, they've been invisible, and including their discourse without coming to the conclusion that American history is really nothing but negative, as opposed to, I think the way we would probably both describe it, is that it's complicated more than it is necessarily negative.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. People have a strong emotional connection, regardless of sort of what side of the so-called debate you're on in the US, because people create their identities in relation to memory, and to be told, well, your memory isn't accurate or something like that, it can be deeply problematic to help people understand themselves as part of an American political community. I think for me, the part of the answer or the solution comes in acknowledging, as you said, that these things are complicated. I think a lot of the way that I've seen this debate framed is, we need to sort of uncover this history that exists at the base of it, that there's this truth, and if we could just uncover it and agree on it, then that's all that's needed. And there's this attempt to persuade the other side of what historical truth really is. But I'm not sure that exists in some ways. I'm not certain there is this sort of uncoverable truth. Not that there's no facts, but when it comes to sort of memories of these things, there's no single story of Robert E. Lee or George Washington or whoever. I mean, these sorts, how we understand our history is a political decision. And part of how these complex sort of figures have become distilled into very sort of linear representations of themselves. And this is part of how historical memory emerges, by distilling the complicated into the simple. But if there's one thing we can do to sort of further this conversation, it's, I think, return back to the complicated from the simple and attempt not to sort of not to simplify this. The question isn't, you know, is Robert E. Lee bad or good? There's a lot of nuance. Good people can do bad things. Bad people can do good things. So I think the question instead is, you know, what values do we agree on that are inclusive in this country? How does that relate to issues that we've had in our history that may still have lingering effects for marginalized populations in the US? And then what do we do about symbols of that history that there may be contestation over? And those conversations are more important than what happens with the statues themselves, from my perspective at least.
Absolutely. In your book, this notion of haunting is sort of this common theme about haunting, that souls or whatever has existed in the past cannot fully rest if there's some injustice that has gone unrecognized or unresolved. You make the reference to the revenant, the concept of the revenant. And actually, one of the things I find fascinating about hauntology-type themes in fiction is typically the ghost cannot rest if there's some injustice that hasn't been addressed. How accurate is that as far as wrestling with the U.S.'s past, that we can't think about putting any of these ghosts to rest without some degree of justice? And is acknowledgement enough of a justice, or should we be talking about things like reparations, restitution, or some physical or some, you know, some specific manifestation of redressing historical injustice?
This is a difficult question, and I think perhaps a question that I shouldn't be answering, because I'm not a member of the populations that have been directly impacted by some of these historical contexts or policies, although I do have immigrant ancestry in the US. But I think that from my perspective, a lot of the injustice comes from our lack of encounter with the sort of complexities associated with this ideas that people, that with these ideas that, not to say that there are not sort of very real material injustices, but when it comes to the debate over the statues, I think the material injustices take their form in these sort of larger stories we tell about American founding and about these sort of key juncture events in US history, like the Civil War. So I think I would say it is a more complex issue than one simple answer to what constitutes justice, but in general, I advocate that populations that have directly experienced injustice or violence historically should be the ones to sort of partner with those in power to develop solutions. And I think this is true whether it is a situation of sort of post-genocide reconciliation or the kind of historical memory issues we're talking about in the US. Regardless of that case, the more I'll call it sort of survivor voices, drawing on the language from a genocide context, but the more survivor voices that are at the table to determine these, I think the less likely you are to see policies that continue to marginalize those voices. That's what we should be aiming for, at least.
Yeah, the importance of conversation and listening. I think it can play a significant role. Now, the president has pushed back on these campaigns and seemingly, you know, sees a political value in what I would term the politics of backlash. The backlash against taking down statues is backlash against altering history. So with that in mind, first of all, how common is this backlash, and how much can we expect that this is going to remain an extremely complicated push and pull of racial identities and community identities within the U.S. that's going to extend well beyond, you know, our current conversation?
I think what we're seeing right now is that the politics of emotion is an incredibly effective and valuable political tactic. And that's on multiple sides of this sort of debate. And I think that has changed the discourse to the point that it's very difficult to have a kind of engaged conversation about the issues that are really at the heart of it. So it has become more about the symbols or the representations than about the sort of actual discussions and debates about history, about how this is impacting populations. So I think that's the issue. And until those that have benefited from the sort of historical policies that were put in place acknowledge that they do have a role in this, or that they do have like skin in the game, so to speak, I don't think we'll see anything change. In the post-World War II German context, they had this sort of informal chant, which was collective guilt, no, collective responsibility, yes. One thing we've seen is that the ideas of guilt and responsibility have become conflated in the way that this discussion is proceeding in the U.S. So I would like to see those separated out a bit, and a real conversation about what responsibility looks like and about how we're collectively responsible for our own history, and then what that means going forward. And that's something very different than individual guilt or even collective guilt. So there may be something to learn from that sort of thing. But do I have any hope that the conversation will turn more towards the sort of meat of the issues at play? Unfortunately, I don't. But I think the first step towards that conversation is beginning, and that is starting to complicate the picture that a lot of Americans have been taught of their own histories, and starting to understand that the story that has been told is not necessarily the only story that exists, and that there have been political choices made about, you know, how we construct our identity through our understanding of history. And that's true in the US, and it's true in other countries as well. But those are political choices, which means we can choose something else. And so in that sense, there's some degree of hope for a better sort of conversation or a better dialogue moving forward.
Absolutely. I think the real key here is that we have choices, and the importance of communication about those choices and the impact that the history has and the empowerment of communities that have typically been left out of the historical discourse and therefore left out of what it means to be American. Thank you very much. Our guest today has been Jessica Auchter. She is the Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, and she is author of the wonderful Politics of Haunting and Memory. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, what will become of liberal arts education, and what might it mean for societies to lose these programs? Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Universities have traditionally been a place for liberal arts learning, but increasingly, even smaller schools are siloing students into professional programs and decreasing their general education requirements. What are the motivations and the implications for this undergraduate education? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Undergraduate education traditionally unfolds with new students exploring general education requirements across liberal arts fields to expose the students to different areas of study. It also develops a student's skills in critical analysis, research tools, and argumentation. Then the student chooses a specific area of study, a major, and specializes in his or her advanced years. But in recent years, students have sought specialization earlier in their academic careers and a lightening of the general education requirements, seeking fields perceived to be more advantageous in their post-college careers. This has put fields such as philosophy, sociology, and the fine arts at risk. On today's show, we explore the future and utility of liberal arts education in undergraduate education. My guests are Michael Tooney, Robert Harrington Endowed Professor of English and the Writing Program Director at Illinois Wesleyan University. He is the author of We Need to Talk, A New Method for Evaluating Poetry with Bob Rudd. Alexandra Monchik is Associate Professor of Musicology at California State University, Northridge. She explores the music of the Weimar Republic and is author of Critical Thinking and Writing Strategies in the Music Bibliography Classroom. And Robert Williams, who is Divisional Dean for the Social Sciences at Seaver College and Professor of Political Science at Pepperdine University. He is the author of Seeking Security in an Insecure World with Dan Caldwell. What inspired this panel is a proposal to significantly reduce the liberal arts faculty at Illinois Wesleyan University, a highly regarded small liberal arts college in Bloomington, Illinois. Full disclosure, I am a graduate of this institution. Professor Tooney, could you begin by giving us a description of what's being proposed to be cut at the university?
Thanks for having me on. So a little bit of backstory, but I'll try to rocket us right up to what's going on right now. So in the past year, the faculty at Illinois Wesleyan undertook a board of trustees mandated comprehensive review of its curriculum by major programs. And so there was a task force that was formed. They used data that was purchased from a consulting firm. Departments submitted reports. And by, I think, about early to mid-April, that group, the Program Evaluation Task Force, had compiled a report that had, in fact, some recommendations that were a part of it about some curricular realignments, places where there might be efficiencies and places for growth. It was pretty clear early on that the effort wasn't really about kind of educational considerations, right? Illinois Wesleyan doesn't really have programs in it that doesn't really serve its mission. It was much more about just thinking a lot about kind of finances for the university and seeing what we could do in terms of streamlining or just kind of getting more efficient and being a bit more imaginative in some of our offerings. Those recommendations were submitted, faculty then made some votes, and all of that then was forwarded to the administration, who just a few days before a mid-May Board of Trustees meeting submitted their own administrative response. And already within that response, there was kind of a seeming kind of shift in what the administrators were kind of seeming to kind of recommend to the board. And what happened was a few things happened at the board meeting. Some votes were taken. Some programs were... There were a few closures. For example, there was an experimental major called Design, Technology, and Entrepreneurship that was closed down as a major, but kind of transformed into other curricular offerings. But what happened a few weeks after that board meeting was that then faculty in the School of Music, French and Italian, Anthropology, Sociology, and Philosophy and Religion were all given letters that their jobs might be terminated. So the administration and or board had spoken with lawyers and thought that that in case terminations were to happen, that this advance notification had to take place. And so my very brief reading of that is that what had been a very kind of collaborative, open process had kind of turned into something that was much more kind of non-transparent, kind of unimaginative, right? It's like, we need to save money. How do we save money? Let's cut a number of humanities offerings. And it really kind of then was an imposition of a kind of vision for what might become of the university that never came back to the faculty. And that's a crucial part in doing, right? The faculty really must own the curriculum at a university. And so there's now this kind of back and forth going on. There will be a board of trustees meeting mid to late next week. And then we'll find out the fates of some of those programs. And of course, there's a lot of various faculty committees are making resolutions. There's a lot of conversation going on and a lot of work happening to see what's going on. But the situation right now is that Illinois Wesleyan is looking at a situation where French anthropology, sociology, philosophy, and religion are essentially under review for that, and a review that might end in the discontinuance of those programs.
And that seems to be consistent with a number of schools, particularly smaller schools, but all schools that face financial considerations. They ask questions like, how many majors are there and how cost effective is this department, as opposed to what's fundamental in a liberal arts education. Now, Professor Montrick, at a school that's much larger than Illinois Wesleyan at California State Northridge, but one that has faced financial difficulties, how much pressure is there at the university to justify your program based on the number of majors as opposed to sort of core, you know, core educational interests?
I think that we're in a paradoxical situation. We are the largest music department in California. And so most of the pressure is not coming from the university, but within the department in terms of the music department, which majors give students the most skills. So what we see is a blossoming of, for example, music business, music industry, we call it at our school, media composition, rather than the traditional fine arts. But one of the paradoxes of being in a music department like I am, and is within a arts college, is that even within the department, there's a push toward a skill-based program. Can you read music? Can you hear this? Do you know these facts? And push back against having a broader general education curriculum within that major, because our accreditation agency has required courses within the music major. So there's been pushback to limit the number of general education courses, which I believe, as someone with a conservatory background and has a doctorate of philosophy, does our students a disservice. I feel like our students need critical thinking skills, which they garner in general education classes. They need writing skills. And as we're looking at the university from the top down, we really need to reconsider what basic skills should the exiting university student have. So we have this preconception that a fine arts degree might be very forward-looking and very broad, but at the same time, we also fall into some other stereotypical majors like business, where there are so many required courses, it puts some of the GEs at risk.
And Professor Williams, you are the one person on the panel that's seen it from the other side as well, as an administrator, as well as a professor. How much is the consideration about who, you know, which programs get funding and which programs are supported are based on this core question of what should a liberal arts education look like versus questions like how many majors are there? Is it financially viable? What exactly are the best ways, you know, to deal with issues of accreditation?
First of all, let me say thank you for inviting me, but also I deeply resent being identified with the administrators. So I'll just put that out there to begin with. But I will say, of course, that it is always the case that administrators are going to be looking at numbers. They're going to be looking at the number of majors. They're going to be looking at the class sizes and those things. And to some extent, that's necessary, obviously. You can't have a faculty of 10 or 15 people teaching four majors or teaching classes that don't make semester after semester, at least not if you're going to be concerned about the overall health of the institution. I think one of the things that we've gotten that has created a problem for us is that as tuitions have increased, and particularly in the private liberal arts colleges, but private institutions more generally, and to an increasing degree, state institutions, as we charge $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for tuition, our students, or maybe more often their parents or whoever is paying the bill, demand return on that investment. And they demand return on that investment in terms of job skills, in terms of some kind of guarantee for employability after graduation. That also is important. That's significant. But what happens, I think, is that quite often that's equated with a particular skill set. It's equated with the ability to do accounting or to do management or something that we know might translate directly into a particular job field. And so the student who wants to study history, musicology, English, political science, that student either has to have a great deal of confidence in his or her ability to kind of translate those skills into something else, or perhaps be independently wealthy or to have the kind of support that's going to follow maybe better networking skills because of family connections that will make that into a career possibility, or that will mean that the major itself doesn't matter. I believe strongly that those liberal arts degrees, that the different majors that we're talking about here, translate extremely well into the workforce and into a wide variety of careers. And I try to make that point at every opportunity I have, but not everybody sees that. And it seems like you're going out on a limb if you're paying a lot of tuition dollars and you're trying to look at the payoff afterwards.
So, Mike Tune, I know you teach courses in both in writing and in poetry. And so, in many ways, I could sort of see the students in your classes being almost archetypical of how is this going to help me get a job, you know, in business, or how is this going to help me get a job in engineering or whatever. What is your response to that query?
Great question. With writing in general, I have no problem answering that. It's obvious that writing is necessary for the kinds of professions and vocations that Illinois Wesleyan hopes that it's preparing its students for, right? People have to be able to communicate well and have to be able to write well. So there's no problem with that. What's fascinating about poetry and creative writing is that I've taken some steps in some classes to actually make sure that some of those connections are very clear. For example, in a 100-level introduction to creative writing class, I actually used a book on creativity. And I said, look, this is a class primarily about creativity. Writing will be our medium, but all of these things will be applicable to other aspects of your life, will enhance your life, will be effective for you. What's beautiful is that in my poetry class at a 200 level, the question doesn't come up. The students have a deep connection to it. They know that I'm certain that there are benefits that accrue that actually turn into kind of its marketable knowledge, all of that. But the students are doing deep work to articulate some truths that they're encountering, to articulate struggles that they're experiencing. That is just wrapped up into, it's coiled in their inner being. So it certainly teaches them a great deal. They learn a lot from that that can be applied. But what's great is that the students, what's amazing is that even in this world where students are, and rightfully so, concerned about profession and thinking about their own economic situation, for me, a poetry class is still just pure evidence that there is this kind, that students still have this real inner life and a real drive to want to give expression to it. And that when they have that opportunity, they do beautiful things with it. And certain other questions just don't even arise. They're clearly secondary or tertiary. It's a thing of beauty, to quote my favorite poet, John Keats.
And Alexander Bonchik, one of the points you made was that you're not offering as many general education classes because of certain requirements within the music school. How much is studying music for somebody who has no interest in pursuing a career in it, but taking it as a general education course, as Professor Tunay pointed out, is really about unlocking creativity, skills that might help you, even if your background, your career is not going to be one necessarily in the creative arts?
Well, I think we discount in studying music and in musicology, music theory, other fields, related fields, is the importance of critical thinking. We tend to think of music as a skill. How fast can you play your scales? Can you phrase this melody accurately? But at least in the courses I teach, in the article I published on, is how do you teach critical thinking to music majors? And I can just give it a couple of examples of what I use, is I read music reviews. And I say, where is this person coming from? What is the tone of the review? Do you think the performance was really bad, or did this person have a bias? Does this person have a national bias, for example? Was this piece performed in Germany during World War II? Was the reviewer French? And once we establish where this person is coming from, we can use those skills and apply it to the media today. And independent of what your political affiliation or views are, learning to read something and think critically about it, how to dissect the piece and saying, how do I take apart the point from the evidence? Is this source secondary? Is it just a summary of something else that's secondary or tertiary? Or is this based on a credible primary source? And I think, again, when we think of music, there, it's either we're learning facts, we're learning to identify a piece, but anyone now can look on Google or Shazam and find out what's happening. When was Beethoven born? Is this the third or the fourth symphony? With just an app. But can you say, why was Beethoven viewed in East Germany in such a way rather than West Germany in such a way? And those are the deeper questions about the music humanities I like to ask and show.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. So, Robert Williams, I know we're living in an age where there's been these calls for much greater critical analysis, say, of news sources or any sort of information. And so part of the general education approach is to build critical analytic skills, as well as an appreciation for numerous ways to approach problems. How much do you see this lack of critical analytic skills that we're starting to see, particularly in this country, as a result of the erosion of some of the emphasis on liberal arts education?
There's a lot of criticism of higher ed. I think the Trump administration policy, the DHS policy, announced just earlier this week to make it difficult for international students to stay in the United States if their college and university programs go online this fall, is part of a general hostility toward higher education from certain parts of the country. You know, I think it's part of the politics of resentment, the politics of sort of narrow identity, but we definitely have a need for what the liberal arts provide in this time in particular. I want to widen this out and just say that the liberal arts, I think, are crucial to democracy, to the survival of democracy. And That's something I think we're struggling with right now. But the founders of the United States were, for the most part, very serious proponents of education, liberal arts education. I'm a graduate of the University of Virginia, Mr. Jefferson's academical village. And of course, he was a strong proponent of public education. But I think what they recognized, and by the way, let me just add, it wasn't just the white guys who founded the United States who believed this. Mary Wollstonecraft believed that education was part of the liberation of women, the emancipation of women. David Walker's appeal in 1829 is an important document that speaks to a lot of important issues for blacks in the United States in the day, but it speaks also to the emancipatory power of education. Frederick Douglass was all about the emancipatory power of education. So this is something that spans the divide, a lot of divides in society. And what I think we have to recognize when we apprehend what liberal education is all about is that this is something that at the same time it emancipates us today, even today, at the same time it makes us, say, less gullible, less likely to fall for the big lie or for, you know, the trolls on the internet. At the same time it does that, it makes our society stronger. Because we as individuals are better able to carry out our responsibilities as citizens when we are educated in the liberal arts, when we have these critical thinking skills that Alexander's been talking about, when we have the ability to appreciate beauty and its opposite, and to be able to know the difference, to be able to identify what it is that makes something beautiful and something else something repulsive. These are critical skills for society. And so I feel like I veered a little way away from your question, but it's a really important point that what makes us better as individuals that we take from the liberal arts also makes our society stronger.
And actually veering away and pointing that out, I think, is absolutely essential in thinking about the role that universities and higher education plays for society. But also, if I can be a bit selfish in asking this question, as an academic, one of the arguments I've made about the need for general education are ways in which I will find things I've learned in fields I would not generally have taken had I been siloed the way that so many students are currently being siloed, that impact on my research and on my teaching, whether it be my own research, which draws heavily not just in international relations, political science, but also history, sociology, even psychology. And then you mentioned beauty. There's a piece that I've used about the nature of meaning in international relations, philosophy, and whether you can break things down based on each of its subsequent parts. And a wonderful piece written saying, well, try to do that with a concept of beauty. And is this an emergent quality that exists independent of our ability to break it down? How do you break down beauty? So the question I'm going to ask all three of you is, do you have examples of that in your own teaching, your own research, where you're drawing on something that you would typically probably not have taken that class had you not been required to do so as a general education requirement, but you found it's had tremendous insights in either your research or your teaching? And I'll start with my teammate.
What a great question. It's the sort of, well, I want to sit and think for 45 minutes on it before giving the answer, because it feels like a crucial question that I have to bare my soul now. So look, I'm dyed in the wool in terms of loving the liberal arts. I got 2 undergraduate degrees, don't ask. I had a double major in English and philosophy, and then in philosophy and theology. And so I'm dyed in the wool. And so I am consistently seeing how things kind of intermesh. And so, for example, in my own teaching and reading of poetry, and especially some of the romantics, You know, I think about a poet like William Blake, who calls the Bible the great code of art, right? And of course, it isn't for all art, but if you're William Blake, it is the great code. And so there's simply no way to engage Blake well without having a good grounding in some of the Christian traditions, including mystical traditions. So for me, it's the best part of the liberal arts. So there's a thinker, Elias Canetti, who talks about how he says knowledge moves not in a straight line, but it moves like a knight moves on a chessboard, right? So it kind of moves ahead and then to the side, that it's kind of skewed and slant. And for me, that's the beautiful thing about the ways that the liberal arts work together and kind of hone each other and inform each other, is that it skews things in this kind of beautiful way, and then affords one new maneuvers and new possibilities. So that the Blake example, though, is one of a thousand examples. It's the aspect of the liberal arts that I kind of love the most, is how they're all mutually informing.
And I appreciate that I put you on the spot by asking that question. But then obviously everyone listening knows these are not rehearsed answers. I will turn to Alexandra. And do you have an example for me?
Yeah, I think I have one from my undergraduate studies and one from my teaching, if you may. And that's, as I said, I had a very straight, fairly conservative conservatory degree in flute performance. But since I went to the University of Michigan, the university mandated we took a certain number of liberal arts classes, even outside of the School of Music. And so as an out-of-state student, I was like last to register, and from a small school with no APs. And so in order to fill a humanities requirement, I got put in a Yiddish literature class in translation with two other students. And it was one of the most rewarding classes of my life. It taught me about history. It taught me about language and translation. So when I deal with my own students, if someone says something a little provocative, I say, okay, how does that translate in the student's native tongue? In translating, it taught me about anti-Semitism and prejudice in general. Oh, there were stereotypes in the 15th century and the 18th century. How do they play out today? And on a personal note, it's made me connect more deeply to my family and my extended family about culture in Yiddishkeit, in Judaism. And in my own teaching, I think I teach a 20th and 21st century music class. And that's always the stereotype where, oh, that's the piece where the people leave and wait for, again, I keep coming back to Beethoven because it's, what, the 250th anniversary? I'll leave after the Beethoven symphony. But when it comes to beauty, what I try to teach my students is, it's not just beauty is in the eye of a beholder, but the arts don't have to be beautiful. They can be provocative. They can make you think. They can challenge you. And so as a music historian and as a musician, what I want to convey is not just beauty, but appreciation and analysis, and not only the conception of a piece, but also the reception of a piece.
So
it's Robert.
Doug, I have too many examples, too many things to say about this. And I'll mention that I started out as a music major myself and decided that I had one of those career-oriented moments where I thought, you know, I have about the talent that would maybe put me in front of a elementary school choir as a director, you know, at that level. And so I switched to something far more practical, which was a history major. And so I've been kind of all over the liberal arts myself. But let me just say, in terms of what I've taken away from the liberal arts, in international politics, there are so many things in the visual arts, in literature, in music for that matter, that I find relevant and important to share with my students. So for example, you know, there's that grim but wonderful poem by Randall Jarrell, The Death of the Ball Turret Gunner. And the first line is, "From my mother's womb, I fell into the state." And that is so evocative for someone thinking about international politics and thinking about the nature of society. You fall into the state and you end up being washed out of the ball turret at the end of this process. That's huge. And that's a way that I can convey to my students just how important statehood is, how important the sovereignty of the state, the kind of system we live in is. But then there's something like Goya and Saturn devouring one of his sons, that gruesome painting that was on one of the walls in his home and is in the Prado now. And, you know, you think about this myth that it conveys, and this is about the state. The fearful state, the dictator who, motivated by a prophecy of his own overthrow at the hands of one of his sons, decides that he'll fix that by devouring them as they are born. And this is what the dictator does. So this is a way that I can convey to students in an international relations class something about the authoritarian state and what it means, and also connect it to their humanities classes at the same time, perhaps. But where all of this kind of comes together for me, and I've been late to this. I wish I had had this insight, or somebody had shared this with me many, many years ago. But where it all comes together for me is in an understanding that in my field, my profession, our professions, but also in life more generally, affect is important. You know, touching the feelings of my students helps them remember things that, you know, they'll, if they cry in class, if I cry in class, they're going to remember that. And they're going to remember the thing it was associated with. If I play Morten Lauridsen's Lux Eterna, you know, at a point where we're talking about genocide, that's going to have an impact. And so many of these things that we talk about are worthy not just because they make us better critical thinkers and because they help to produce skills that sometimes we call soft skills, you know, that are going to enhance our work in whatever field. Some of these things are important because they enhance our ability to feel and to convey feelings. And that's a large part of what makes us human, as I understand it. And it really works well in a classroom, in a committee meeting, in a sermon, you know, wherever you put these things, that affective side of things that comes in large measure from the poets and from the musicians and from the artists, that's important to us, vitally important.
So it's kind of a reminder that education is not just even necessarily, it's not necessarily about preparing your postgraduate career, and not necessarily even just about developing skills, but also developing the ability to live a life worth living. And I talk about that, you know, in my classes, that it's about living a life worth living, dying a death worth of dying, those, you know, those sorts of broader questions, and as they relate to issues, you know, peace and conflict sorts of questions. But I also like to talk about taking an art and a music appreciation, or kind of a history of art, history of music, which have given me nothing but enjoyment, because it allows me to go to a museum and appreciate what I'm seeing, or go to a chamber concert, or go to a, you know, a performance and appreciate what I'm listening to. So I'll turn to Alexandra first, and then we'll finish with Mike. How much should our education really be about not just developing skills, but learning to appreciate all that's around you and living a good life?
I think if I may answer your question mostly roundabout way, is what I see here is I take that for granted as a musician. And with the increase of the commodification of education and a skills-based education, I'll start here. I think our job as university professors, and I think the administration job, should be on how to translate those skills practically. We need to do a better job of how to show students how to market themselves, to translate their critical thinking, their writing skills, their analytical skills to a resume. But we're talking about here, and what I think you're telling me is life skills. and enjoyment skills. And for me, sure, being familiar with the arts or literature is important to me, but if we can somehow find a way to relate, if I can hear a symphony and break down the melody and the harmony and the rhythm and the form, that also gives me subconscious analytical skills to break down texts, to break down arguments, to go into an art museum and see a painting and look at the texture versus the color palette versus the emotional response, the initial reaction I have to it. And so I think it broadens out from appreciation. And then to make the case, it's from appreciation to meaning. And then what does appreciation and meaning actually practically extend to?
Absolutely. And I will do that sometimes with film or with, you know, with television research I do on historical memory. And one of my favorite things to say to students when it feels that I may be overly analytical is, welcome to my world. It's a wonderful place because you can appreciate all of these different things. Thank you very much to our guests. We've discussed the importance of liberal arts education and the university in developing full people, full scholars, and learning from one another's backgrounds. Our guests have been Michael Tune, the Robert Harrington Endowed Professor of English and Writing Program Director at Illinois Wesleyan University. He's the author of We Need to Talk, A New Method for Evaluating Poetry. Alexandra Manchik is Associate Professor of Musicology at California State University, Northridge. She is the author of Critical Thinking and Writing Strategies in the Music Bibliography Classroom. And Robert Williams, Professor of Political Science at Pepperdine University. He is the author of Seeking Security in an Insecure World. Thank you very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
Tuned.